watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, I have two talks to play for you that illuminate the extent to which the so-called war on terrorism specifically and the concept of national security generally is about the bottom line. You'll hear this week how it resembles the Cold War in many ways, from red scares at home to wars abroad. At home, the target is people whose politics threaten profits. Abroad, ditto. There's a matrix of relationships designed to defend these financial interests. It involves nearly every influential sector of society, and our speakers will go into detail on who some of the key actors have been and what laws and policies have resulted. In the first hour, we'll hear from Peter Phillips, director of Project Censored. And in the second hour, Will Potter, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist with a talk, The Green Scare, Eco-Activism in the Age of Terror. Our first talk comes to us courtesy of Voices for Global Justice in Los Angeles.
Peter Phillips is a professor of sociology at Sonoma State University and has been the director of Project Censored since 1996. Project Censored, launched in 1976, is a national media research group which tracks the news published in independent journals and newsletters. From these, Project Censored compiles an annual list of 25 news stories of social significance that have been overlooked, underreported, or self-censored by the country's major national news media. Peter Phillips gave a talk on some of Project Censored's 2007 issues due in next year at the First Unitarian Universalist Church of San Diego, California, on July 25th, 2007.
Thank you very much. 31 years Project Censored has been doing this research and work, and I have lots of help. Over 200 faculty and students every year. It's about 100 students involved. And they're sorting out, we call it investigative sociology, investigative journalism, because we get students from both disciplines. And they're sorting out cross-checking news, they're developing their research skills, they're distinguishing between fact and opinion, and they pick these stories from thousands, and we narrow them down to the 25 each year. It's a year process. And we do investigative work as well. On our website is a recent study from last December posted called Electromagnetic Weapons and Human Rights, the government's research into EMF weapons technologies. We have another study that I'll talk a little bit about tonight, too, called the Global Dominance Group, which is about a year old, and that's who are the people in the United States that are pushing military domination of the world. And we have a new study coming out this month called Standard Practices in Health Care and Disability, Deny, Diminish, Delay, and Blame. And that'll be out this month. So looking back 31 years, when Carl Jensen started, they just started looking at independent publications and seeing stories that the corporate media wasn't covering. And at that time, there was 50 major media corporations in the U.S. And Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman were working on what became known as their book, Manufacturing Consent. And the social science was coming up with theories why media wasn't covering all the important issues in the U.S. But according to Herman and Chomsky, the media maintains a corporate class bias through five filter systems: concentrated private ownership, a strict bottom line profit orientation, an over-reliance on government and corporate sources for news, a tendency to avoid offending the powerful, and an almost religious worship of the market economy, and strongly opposing any alternative beliefs. So this was coming out of the Cold War. This was a way of understanding how media was working at that time. Now, the dangers of these kinds of filters is that it makes identifying censorship is really indirect. Now, that we have many cases of overt censorship that are occurring inside corporate media, and we can cite a number of those. But overall, it's a massive system. And the owners and the managers, they share a class identity with the powerful. And they're motivated economically to please their advertisers, and the viewers, for that matter. And their conception of what is newsworthy is influenced by their social background, their values, and what they call common sense. So journalists and editors are not immune from influence from owners and managers, and journalists want to see their stories in print. And editors come to know the limits, or what we call the parameters, of the common sense view of the world. So a whole lot of what passes for censorship or manufacturing consent is structural, in that journalists and editors come to understand what's acceptable news. And it's just part of the system. It's common sense within the system. So a lot of reasons these stories don't come out is kind of what we call self-censorship. They're just not seen as appropriate, or there's restricted in the filters or preventing that process. We also know that essentially the corporate media in the U.S. is in the entertainment business. Now, you know, we went back and checked when Paris Hilton went to jail. Fox News, in 3 weeks, had 56 headline stories on Paris Hilton. Now, I understand that Lindsay Lohan has just got arrested, so I think that's going to continue to be making the news as we go along. And so there's a, you know, whether it's Anna Nicole Smith dying or having her baby and all of that, there's an entertainment value that has an opportunity cost. So Neil Postman called the American society the best entertained, least informed society in the world. He said that 15 years ago, and that's becoming increasingly more evident today. So there's been a gold rush since the passage of the Telecommunications Act under Clinton's watch, 1996. Media mergers have just rapidly happened in this country. We have, you know, AOL, Time Warner, CNN has become the biggest media organization in the world. And we now have, from what was 50 when the project started, we're down to 10 major media corporations in the United States today. And Clear Channel owns 1,200 radio stations, and almost all the cities, 98% of the cities in the country, have just one daily newspaper. And it was fairly common 100 years ago that cities had 5 and 10 newspapers. And around the world, it's quite common that they're, you know, in Athens, there's 12 dailies. But here we get one daily, and often those are owned by chains. So this 24-hour news systems of MSNBC, Fox, and CNN, they're interconnected with sources of news, both government and corporations. And they have to have continuous news feeds. So CNN keeps an office in the Pentagon. And so there's a constant news feed that there's always stimulating events, breaking news bites that are needed. And this, of course, is all run by advertisement for mass consumption. And so prepackaged sources of news become vital to the system. They need to have PR firms and government press releases in order to kind of keep the content full. We know about embedded reporters working directly with military units in the field. They maintain a cooperative working relationship with their unit commanders. If they don't, they have to leave. It's really cooperative reporting. And this is, you know, you'd have to operate that way in order to continue to have access to government news sources. Journalists who fail to recognize this role, who still think that they are independent, news-gathering, investigative reporters, are going to be disciplined. And the celebrity cases at the beginning of the Iraq War were Geraldo Rivera and Peter Arnett. They're out. You don't hear them anymore. So this is kind of a symbiotic relationship between a conscious, deliberate attempt by the powerful to control the news and kind of an acceptance of that by the corporate media in the U.S. Now, this has been codified, and if we look at this, the Homeland Security Act, Title II, Section 201D, specifically asks Homeland Security to develop a plan for securing the key resources and critical infrastructure in the United States, including information technology, telecommunication systems, and all satellites and all communication systems. So built into Homeland Security is the desire to be able to control information flow. Now, as we sort out the post-9/11 feelings about the media system, we start to see some really dynamic things happen. Public relation firms are merging rapidly since 9/11. The three biggest ones in the world now are Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Group. These have been mergers of other firms that had existed, and since 9/11, it's been very profitable for them to merge and contract directly with governments and corporations for news preparation, news story preparing. They employ 163,000 people in 170 countries. So these are the creators of news. WPP is a UK-based conglomerate. Formerly, some of their subsidiaries were Young and Rubicam, Burston Marsteller, Ogilvy and Mather, and Hill and Knowlton. Now Hill and Knowlton was we kind of heard about them back during the first Gulf War, because they helped orchestrate testimony before Congress. And a woman named Nayera, who claimed that she was in Kuwait City when the Iraqis invaded, that she was working as a nurse in the hospital, she said, and this was on national television, this was testimony before Congress, she said the Iraqi soldiers came into the hospital with guns drawn, and they went into the room with 15 babies in incubators, and they took the babies out of the incubators and dumped them on the floor. And she was tearful and crying before Congress. I mean, this was part of the pre-war justification for how awful the Iraqis were. And what was the public was not told and was that Nayera was the daughter of Nasser al-Sabat, who was the Kuwaiti's ambassador to the U.S. And that the public was not told also that the performance was coordinated by the White House and choreographed by the public relations firm Hill and Knowlton. So deliberate lying to Congress, deliberate creation, fabrication of stories. Some of these companies specialize in war. The Rendon Group is one of the firms hired for the PR management of America's preemptive wars. In the 1980s, the Rendon Group helped form American anti-Noriega sentiment in terms of, you know, it was okay to go invade Panama. They helped shape the support for the first Gulf War. They were the ones that actually created the Iraqi National Congress and handpicked Ahmad Shalabi to be the head of that. So the Iraqi Congress was created by a PR firm, the Rendon Group. They were the ones that orchestrated the toppling of the statue, the pulling down of the Saddam Hussein statue. They got the Iraqi Congress people to come, and they were the ones cheering on, they're pulling it down. It was a fabricated event conducted in front of the Palestine Hotel where all the journalists were staying. They also were the ones that helped part of Jessica Lynch's historic rescue, except they couldn't get the cameras there on time, so they delayed the rescue. The special forces delayed her rescue a day so that the cameras could get there. Also, it was the day that we were invading Baghdad. The tanks were rolling to Baghdad. So in the U.S., the corporate media is covering Jessica Lynch's rescue, And tanks are rolling into the streets, shelling the Palestine Hotel. We killed journalists there. We bombed Al Jazeera. We killed their journalists. That we found out about much later. That was not in the media on those days. So PR firms have become a way of what we call it, when I say new American censorship, of sorting out and controlling news through these firms, and in some cases overtly fabricating news or overtly creating situations that get coverage or controlling information when it's getting out of hand. So the amount of money, if we look back now, the Clinton administration spent $38 million there last year in terms of public relations. So governments have always done this. But if we look at it now, Henry Waxman's committee found out that under the Bush administration from 2003 to 2005, was actually an 18-month period, they spent $1.6 billion on PR contracts. And so massive, and a billion of that was the Pentagon. So this is money spent for PR firms, for press releases, for paying journalists to write stories. And so this is, when we say new American censorship, we have a whole different structural thing. It's beyond simply manufacturing consent of Chomsky and Herman. It has gone into the deliberate manufacturing and control of information in American society. And we look at these top 10 big media groups, and we also look at the people making profits from war. The Carlyle Group, William Kennard is on their board of directors. He's also on the board of directors of the New York Times. Douglas Warner III, who is on Bechtel's board, one of the top defense contractors in the country, also sits on NBC. John Bryson, who is on the board of directors of Boeing, he sits on ABC's board. Allison Lewis, who's a director on Halliburton, also sits on ABC's board. Douglas McCorkindale, who is part of Lockheed Martin's board of directors, also sits on the Gannett board. So we got five of the top 10 biggest media groups with people from the top defense contractors in the United States actually sitting on their board of directors. So as stories emerge, it's not difficult to start to understand why these stories aren't being covered. And people ask me all the time, is it getting worse? And absolutely, the answer is yes. It is getting far worse. So let's take a look. I think one case that has been bothering me now for almost 2 years. It was October of 2005. The American Civil Liberties Union released copies of 44 autopsy reports that they had acquired on civilians who had died while in U.S. custody in Afghanistan and Iraq in 2002, 3, and 4. Now, these were autopsy reports conducted by U.S. military doctors on civilians who had died while in custody of the United States forces. So this wasn't Abu Ghraib. I mean, Abu Ghraib was part of it, but it was prisons all over both countries. All branches of the military service. 23 of those autopsy reports, the cause of death was listed as homicide. They were murdered while in custody. The descriptions of the bodies are horrendous. Broken bones, contusions, defensive wounds, restraints, extensive body damage. ACLU could say nothing but the autopsy reports prove that these people were tortured to death. And the 23 autopsy reports they had, 21, wasn't homicide listed. They primarily died from heart failure while being tortured. So this was way beyond Abu Ghraib. I mean, this wasn't sexual humiliation. This was overt torture to death. And ACLU puts out a press release. The Associated Press in the United States picks it up. They sent it out to... They had a 1,000-word story. It went out to 1,700 dailies in the U.S. It went out to all 5,000 television and radio news programs. 12. 12 newspapers in the country covered the story, less than 1%. The biggest being the Los Angeles Times, and it was on page A4, and that was it. It was never mentioned again. No editorials on it, never mentioned. So 99 out of 100 editors in the country, MSNBC put it on their website but didn't consider it newsworthy on television. 99 out of 100 editors, for some reason, decided that the American public didn't need to know that the U.S. was torturing people to death. I still can't understand the logic there. Maybe it's just too contradictory. They thought they'd get too much flack over it. It goes against our ingrained values. We don't do that. There's, you know, it might be a few soldiers that get out of hand, and we punish them. No, this was systematic across two nations, multiple forces, where people were being tortured to death. The left independent press, we find that Mother Jones covered the story. Truth Out covered it. Common Dreams had an article on it. And so did ZNet. So there was some coverage in the left progressive press. But in these times, BuzzFlash, The Progressive, Alternet, The Nation, and Democracy Now! Did not cover the story. And I have respect for all of those organizations, but for some reason, it didn't get in. Now, this was available to everybody. I mean, AP puts it out, it's there. I mean, everybody can see it. You can go back and you can see the releases and the coverage from AP. So there's some mechanism of continuing self-censorship that's going on literally in all media in the United States today. And that's something that I think is really important to address and something that we have to continue to think about and be aware of. Now, our number one story that's going to come out in our Censored 2008 book, which will be out in about 2 months, and I've really been talking about this since the law was passed, and this is the Military Commissions Act of October 17th, 2006. That act allows for the suspension of habeas corpus for any person in the United States. Citizens or non-citizens, both. It says any person. It doesn't just say terrorists. It says any person can be designated an enemy combatant and put in a prison without any rights of produce the body, which is what habeas corpus means. No attorneys, no hearings, no produce the body. You just disappear. Now, there is a distinction between citizens and non-citizens in this act. Non-citizens, legal or illegal, can be locked up without habeas corpus, even for pending designation as an enemy combatant by the president. So that could take months, years. So the 24 million plus people who are here on green cards and or even illegally can be locked up literally forever with no legal rights pending. I mean, this is the law. This is the law of the land right now. Now, the New York Times, they covered it, and they said, oh, well, it's really just for terrorists, and don't worry about it. It's not for you or me or anybody else, but the law is on the books. Now, there is an effort in Congress to, it's called the Restore the Habeas Corpus Law. But you don't know about that. You're not, I mean, it's not covered in the newspapers, the consequences of how this could affect any single person in this country, let alone the long history of what habeas corpus means and the values of that in a democratic society and the 700-year history in English common law that implies. That's missing from the public dialogue on how what's going on in the country today. The same day, Bush signed the Defense Authorization Act of 2007, also known as the Warner Act. And this is how the president can station troops anywhere in America, take control of the state-based National Guards without the consent of the governors, and to suppress any kind of public disorder the president designates as needing to be put down. So this act allows for the suspension of what we came to know as posse comitatus, that is, the use of federal troops. Not, you know, for law enforcement was passed after the Civil War to prevent the Union from occupying the South with military and them being the police. And that has been part of our American tradition for 150 years. And that was done away with without commentary, without editorials in the paper, without educating the American people, the extent and the degree to which this makes martial law absolutely easy. At the same time, over the last 2 years, we've been operating under the code name Operation Falcon, federal and local cops organized nationally, unprecedented, federally controlled mass arrest practicing. This has happened 3 times, April 2005, October 2006, and again last year, where 960 federal, all the FBI, the Selective Service, the IRS, all the intelligence agencies, coordinated through Homeland Security and the Justice Department, simultaneously working with state police, all this, the SWAT teams, the federally funded SWAT teams in every city in the country, 960 different agencies simultaneously arresting 10,000 people. They've done it 3 times. Over 30,000 people have been arrested. Now, they like to say, well, we caught 237 sex offenders and we caught this number of felons. Now, supposedly, all these people were felons. Now, historically, if there's a felony arrest warrant for Rudolph Schmidt, who's, you know, living down the street, the cops went and arrested Rudolph and took him to jail. This is the first time that the federal government has ever coordinated all simultaneously all the police forces in the country to do mass arrests, practice mass arrests, literally. I mean, that's what that is. And any list of 10,000 people could be put in there. So when we look at what's been happening to the immigrants in this country, and we have to kind of look at that in context, the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, detonated explosive growth of Mexican immigrants into the U.S. We displaced millions of Mexican farm worker jobs in Mexico because of the increased flooding of Mexico with cheap grains from the U.S., particularly corn. And Mexico in the last 5 years has lost 900,000 rural jobs and 700,000 industrial jobs. So this creates a situation where a person is, the family is literally living in poverty, they're starving, and so come to the U.S. to get the minimum wage job or work for whatever they can. And thousands of people, as we know, are doing that. Now, in the wake of 9/11, Immigration Customs Enforcement, now known as ICE, has conducted workplace and home invasion raids across the country in an attempt to round up, quote, illegal immigrants. Now, ICE justifies these raids under the rubric of keeping our homeland safe and preventing terrorism. There has been no evidence of anybody from Mexico coming up in terms of terrorist activity. But that's been the justification. You know, the real goal of action is to disrupt the immigrant workforce in the country. And this policy is endorsed by companies seeking low-wage workers through a lobby group called Essential Worker Immigrants Coalition. And this has 52 corporate members, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Walmart, Marriott, Tyson Foods, American Meat Institute, the California Landscape Contractors Association, the Association of Builders and Contractors, people that will use low-income labor. What they're really trying to do is create guest worker programs, whereby tens of thousands of Mexican men and women come to work under contracts here in the U.S., undermining the existing workers here already, breaking that cycle, and then, of course, being closely regulated and being paid low wages, no unions, and then sent back to Mexico when they're done with them. So this is part of, you know, Bush's real push for a guest worker program. It's part of the ICE raids nationally, and it's all tied in under the rubric of Homeland Security and protecting the country from terrorists. Now, to help with that, Halliburton received a no-bid contract last year from Homeland Security to build $385 million worth of detention centers around the country. So as these raids are occurring, people are being shipped off into detention centers along the border, thousands of people living in these prisons. getting either to be deported, some for months on end. They're actually, now we have contracted also with a new police state program, whereby the government is contracting with Lockheed Martin to develop a blimp 17 times bigger than the Goodyear blimp that would be a stratolite. It would sit up 60,000 feet in the air, and it could photograph with high-resolution cameras, just have images, and this is better than satellites, of a 600-square-mile area. So the envision was to build these things and have them along the border, and then perhaps eventually everywhere in the country, so that you had a constant vision of the entire population areas of being able to watch what was going on and where people were going. Which brings me to Blackwater, because Blackwater is building a stratolite of their own. They want to be able to use it in theater operations wherever they're engaging in military activities around the world. Now, Blackwater embodies kind of the privatization of the military-industrial complex. I remember Eisenhower warned us about that 50 years ago and saying, you know, let's watch out for this, because after World War II, they never wanted to quit giving the money to the corporations to continue to build defense industry. Blackwater now has over 20,000 soldiers. They've got private military base, a fleet of aircraft, helicopter gunships, a private intelligence division, and they're building this surveillance blimp so that wherever they're operating, they can use this from high up in the sky and see everything that's going on. Now, one of the last things Dick Cheney did before he left office under George H.W. Bush was to create a commission, a study, Halliburton did the study, to study how to privatize the military bureaucracy. And that study effectively created the groundwork for what has become a private profit bonanza for certain corporations in the Iraq War. So Blackwater, which began in 96, has been one of the ones of taking in a great deal of money in this regard. Now, in the State of the Union address in 2007, Bush asked Congress to authorize an increase in active service Army and Marines by 92,000 people over the next 5 years. So continue to build the military. I mean, this is what the Project for New American Century called for. It was a continued expansion and growth of the military, 6 to 8% a month, you know, indefinitely, for total military domination of the world. A second task that he talked about was to work to design and develop a volunteer civilian reserve. This would ease the burden on the armed forces by allowing them to hire civilians with critical skills to serve on missions abroad when America needs them. He's saying this in the State of the Union address. Now, Blackwater stepping up the plate, as are a number of other private military contractors around the world, to literally build a private military service that can be hired by corporations, can be hired by governments, can be hired by anybody with the money anywhere in the world to kill people, protect people, blow things up, whatever they choose to do. If we look at who's on the board of directors of Blackwater, we find Joseph Smith, the former Pentagon Inspector General. We find Fred Fielding, Ken Starr, Whitewater prosecutor, is their chief counsel. And Kofor Black, who was a 30-year CIA veteran, former head of the CIA's Counterintelligence Center, is also on their board. So we see close interlocks with this private mercenary group and government officials and the CIA and the intelligence service. So also going along these lines is the expanded use of the word terrorism in American media, or the threats of terrorism and that. But also this includes domestic terrorism and passing of laws that use terrorism as part of the justification for the law. Now, how many have ever heard of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act? Last year, I mean, this should have been in all the papers. I mean, this is November 27, 2006. Broadens punishments under the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, and they call any animal enterprise is any U.S. business that uses or sells animal products. Now, I think you'll be hard-pressed to think of those that don't, whether it's milk or wool or whatever. I mean, that covers most businesses in the country. And it says any interference with the business, including their loss of their profits, is a terrorist act. And any interference with any person or entity having any connection or relationship or transaction with any animal enterprises. Now, we know that this is theoretically aimed at those that are burning down the slaughterhouses and that sort of thing, but the language is so broad that it could literally make terrorists out of boycotters of a grocery store. And this is called domestic terrorism. So part of understanding this loss of civil liberties that's been occurring, the habeas corpus, the Warner Act, the terrorist acts, all of this, and the increased surveillance of American citizens and that, is really understanding where the leadership class, the people in power today, are coming from and where they're going. The U.S. is now dominated by a neoconservative group of people with the shared goal of aggressively asserting U.S. military power worldwide. Now, this comes out of the University of Chicago's Committee of Social Thought. Leo Strauss and Paul Wolfowitz, Alan Bloom, Richard Perle were students. This was back in the 60s. They were working on neoconservatism. What does that mean, and where are we going with this? And Adbusters, kind of one of my favorite magazines, says that the neoconservatives believe that their belief in democracy is that, however flawed, is best defended by an ignorant public pumped up on nationalism and religion, and only a militantly nationalist state can deter human aggression. In other words, we have to be powerful and strong to deter the aggressors around the world. And such nationalism requires an external threat. And if one can't be found, then you manufacture it. So that's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's pretty clear what they were about. And when George H.W. Bush got into power in the presidency, we had Cheney was Secretary of Defense, and we see the expansion of neoconservatives, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Libby, Khalilzad, that are part of that group. And, it was in 92 that Cheney, Lewis Libby, and Wolfowitz wrote what was called the Defense Planning Guidance Report. And this advocated for the U.S. military dominance of the globe. And they started using terminology like the New World Order. Remember Bush the First used that when during the first Iraq War. I mean, so those were these key terms, the New World Order, U.S. leading the world militarily. And called for the prevention of any rivals that would challenge us, unilateral action, military forward presence. I mean, that terminology, we're going back here to 92, it was really written down. I mean, we were thinking it long before that, but we start to see this being written down. So that U.S. must be absolutely powerful. Now, Bush the First didn't win his second term. He was supposed to, but that didn't happen. Clinton got in. So Clinton has to come in and deal with some of this. And part of it is the defense contractor saying, well, look, we want to keep military spending up. The Soviet Union's no longer the big threat that it was. The whole Cold War thing, massive military spending. So, there were people in Congress advocating for cutting the military and using the money for social services and programs and kid centers and all that stuff. And it never happened. I mean, they cut it a little bit back during the first part of the Clinton administration, but it didn't expand as much as the neocons wanted it to as well. What Clinton did, and he was very good at it, he got Ron Brown and other people in the government to really promote U.S. weapons sales to keep the companies profitable. So during the Clinton administration, we went from one-third of the weapons sales in the world to two-thirds. And part of that was beating the Russians out, and they weren't selling as much. But it was a deliberate attempt to keep the weapons companies profitable, and they made it legal for the big mergers. So we got Lockheed and Martin, Northrop and Grumman. So these big companies were merged during the Clinton administration to facilitate very, very specialized military production companies that continue to grow and expand. So they're there. And they're maintaining, they're selling, and they're kind of keeping going. And the neoconservatives who are out, but they're hanging out in the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and they formed this group called the Project for New American Century, PNAC. And so they start reprinting their stuff from 92, you know, global dominance, continued military expansion, we want to have, you know, new world order. And they have a, you know, statement of principles. We're going to increase defense spending significantly. You know, half of these guys are straight out of Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. And they're writing this kind of material back then. Elliot Abrams, Jeb Bush, I mean, George W. wasn't even involved. It was Jeb who was involved. And Khalilzad, Libby, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Abrams, William Bennett, I mean, a lot of these names we still hear. Most of them ended up in George W. Bush's administration. And they have a report that they bring out in 2000. They were strong advocates for invading Iraq back. They would really push Clinton to, you know, invade Iraq in 98. And so they come out with Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategies, Forces, and Resources for a New Century. So they're laying out the map for U.S. military global dominance for the next 100 years. And they're calling for total military control of the world, a Pax Americana. Any rivals such as Iran, Iraq, North Korea have to be held in check, and they specifically talk about China. I mean, the Chinese are seen as our main economic rival for future control of the world. And you want to have to accelerate global dominance, continued military spending, 6-8% increase annually, and to, you know, to push profits for the defense industry. So when we this is the kind of the historical background of where we are today. So when we talk about, you know, impeaching Bush and Cheney, it isn't, I mean, it's just not them. We're talking about a military-industrial complex that has been tightly narrowed, several major big companies, huge profits, 300% increase in stock values for Lockheed Martin, same for Halliburton. Carlyle's made massive fortunes. Northrop Grumman, same thing. So in order to continue that, to justify that continued expansion, to maintain our 700 bases worldwide, to continue to, you know, create, expand the military, we need a war on terrorism. And part of justifying that is to look at where they're coming from with this. Now, so Cheney gave a speech a year ago in March, and this speech is to AIPAC, American-Israeli Policy Council. So he's saying, this is his exact words, Israel and the United States and all civilized nations will win the war on terror. To prevail in this fight, we must understand the nature of the enemy. As America experienced on September 11, 2001, the terrorist enemy is brutal and heartless. The enemy wears no uniform, has no regard for the rules of warfare, unconstrained by any standard of decency or morality. The terrorists want to end all American and Western influence in the Middle East. Their goal in that region is to seize control of a country, so they will have a base in which to launch attacks and wage war against governments that do not meet their demands, ultimately to establish a totalitarian empire that encompasses a region from Spain, across North Africa, through the Middle East, South Asia, all the way to Indonesia, the Muslim world. So Cheney's response to this is there's evil terrorists everywhere. They're throughout the Muslim world. They want to build a Muslim empire. So we have to occupy these regions, literally, to prevent that. So that's the logic. I mean, that's what we're dealing with. That's U.S. military domination of the world. It means weapons from space. It means stratolites. It means forward deployment of troops. It means encircling China. It means preventing the Chinese from military expansion and expansion in terms of controlling their resources, particularly their oil. I mean, Chinese buy their oil from Iran. So all this saber-rattling around Iran is partly about that. Also, the other hotspots, Somalia and the Sudan, Chinese have oil developments there. So it's part of a containment of Chinese oil needs and expansion for that country to continue to grow rapidly. And that's simultaneously our assertion of military power in the world. And it's trying to protect the dollar as the currency for which oil is bought around the world. Because hundreds of billions of dollars are exchanged in terms of the oil. Now, Saddam Hussein was the first member of OPEC to switch over to euros. And he did that 2 years before we invaded. The first thing Bremer does when he gets back is switch it back. So all the oil sold from Iraq is in dollars. Last week, the Iranians started selling oil to the Japanese in yen. And as that happens, and the dollar, hundreds of billions around the world, Chavez has been threatening to start selling oil in euros. That money, if it floods back, we're going to see the cost prices in Walmart triple in a year. So, we're artificially protecting this dollar, but we're doing it militarily. So we're spending more than the rest of the world combined on U.S. military, and it has a cost, and it ultimately will have a cost that catches up with us. I mean, we're even establishing, this is one of our stories this year, military command structure in Africa. It's called AFRICON. Right now it's based in Europe. They're trying to find a nation that's friendly, to find somebody we can bribe enough to get the military command established there. They want to get it established by the end of the year, and to fight the global war on terror. So we're going to have a military command structure in the continent of Africa, and it's primarily to control China's advancement and economic interests in that area. So I'll talk a little bit about impeachment. And we wrote the book, Impeach the President. We have 12 reasons why we should. But really what we're talking about is lying to the American people deliberately to launch the war in Iraq. I mean, we've got that stone cold heart. I mean, there's the Downing Street memos prove that they lied. I mean, they were going to manipulate the evidence. It's quite clear. There's just no doubt. They knew. They were lying. It wasn't any phony information. They manipulated the data, and they told us about weapons of mass destruction with overt lies. I mean, that's reason enough. And that's reason number one on the impeachment that Kucinich has against Cheney. Authorizing and directing torture of thousands of captives, leading to death, extreme pain, disfigurement. That's a pretty good reason for impeaching the people in power today. And it's not just Bush and Cheney. I mean, it's all of these neoconservatives, but we have to recognize the degree to which this power structure has been dominated by this global dominance ideology. Building an imperial presidency. Bush has done more signing statements than all the other presidents put together. Like 950. And so every time they pass a law, he signs a law and then says, well, we don't have to follow it for this reason, or, the presidency is exempt. Ordering free fire zones in Iraq. Bombing civilian cities. We know now that from the John Hopkins studies, and there's been two of them, that as of a year ago, with 650,000 civilians dead in Iraq since the war started. This is civilians in excess of what had been normal death rates in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. That's about 10,000 people dying a month. So when someone says, well, we don't want to impeach now, we'll have to wait, we'll get the Democrats in, and then they'll end the war, and it might take a while, but we're talking about 10,000 civilian deaths a month. That's a big reason for impeachment now and ending the war now. Thank you. It's morally bankrupt for who's ever making these decisions in the Democratic Party, not for impeachment, to say, well, if we wait, then we'll have the war issue and it'll make us stronger as a party in 2008. That's simply not acceptable, and that's why Cindy Sheehan's in Washington today. That's why the world can't wait is acting so hard. And those are the issues that go beyond what's a good political tactic. They go to our hearts. They go to what's right. They go to, we know torture's not right. We know that kind of civilian death rate is not right. And that's why we have to work so hard and address it so strongly. Besides, Bush has never won a presidential election. I mean, Gore is finally kind of admitting, yeah, well, I really did win Florida in 2000, but maybe we should have pushed it harder. And Carter finally admitted a couple of years ago, yeah, Gore won in 2000. I mean, when they counted all the votes and all the little chads and all that kind of stuff, he won by 150,000 votes. And that information came out about 2 weeks after 9/11, so nobody paid much attention. I mean, 9/11 has dominated our psyche for since that happened. And, you know, and so in 2004, this idea that someone would cheat on an election, oh, my God, in America, doesn't happen. So, you know, the Ukraine election, we overthrow it because the exit polls show that it was all off. Our exit polls show that 10 million votes were changed in the voting machines in 13 states in 2004. That's Steve Freeman's work, University of Pennsylvania. It's just factual. They can't be that wrong. The chances are millions to one that the exit polls are that wrong. Even in California, it was excessive. So the only possibility is that in some way, and we don't know how, we don't know who, but in some way, voting machine tallies were either pre-programmed or changed through the Internet or changed somehow for the 2004 election. And we're looking pretty hard at the 2006, but the surge, the Democratic surge, was so powerful it seems to have overwhelmed it. But Tom Hartman is saying that he thinks that there could have been 20 more Democrats in Congress had there not been cheating in that election as well. So I haven't seen the data on it, and I still want to talk to Steve Freeman about it, but we may save that as a story next year or something. But that's there. I mean, and the evidence is quite clear. It's quite there. So when we talk about impeachment, the July 10th poll from American Research Group said, you know, we've got 54% of the people in the country support impeachment of Cheney. That's a vast majority. I mean, it's a big majority because there's only 40% that don't want him impeached. So, I mean, this is starting to reach magic because we were at a third a year ago. So as this comes forward, and the impeach Bush, the numbers are split. 45, 45, 45, 46, right in there. And the rest of the other people aren't sure. But so we've got a lot of people saying that this has to happen. Now, Kucinich has House Resolution 333. This has been presented to the House. Conyers needs to bring that forward in the Judiciary Committee. He's got 13, 14 co-sponsors, including Maxine Waters, Barbara Lee, Lynn Woolsey from California, those three from California. And yes, for them. We're running. Somebody tonight told me it's up to 80. The last time I checked, it was 77 cities in the country have voted for impeachment through their city councils. San Francisco, Detroit, Richmond, Virginia, Berkeley. I mean, a lot. These aren't just the university towns. I mean, these are cities all over the country. The whole state of Vermont's voted that way. We've got the Democratic parties in California here. I mean, how many saw that in the newspaper after all the Democrats were down here, right? And they voted to impeach the president. And was that on the front pages of the papers in the country the next day? Not at all. I mean, you know, the Democrats all together, the state convention, and they vote to impeach the president, doesn't make the news. Alaska, Colorado, Hawaii, Maine, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Mexico, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, Wisconsin, they've all voted for impeachment. And the Green Party nationally voted for impeachment, and the Green Party of California has voted for impeachment. So we're running pretty high here, folks, in terms of people that want to see the president impeached. And if there was ever a president to be impeached, this is the one that's the one we've got now. We got these national groups. World Can't Wait has Wear Orange on Friday. If you want to, you know, stop impeachment, my co-editor, Dennis Liu, that was his idea in our impeachment book. After Downing Street, they've got all the memos. They've got all the work that they've done. Code Pink's very involved in this. Democrats.com, the Gold Star Families, the Hip Hop Congress, the Howard Zinn, Ramsey Clark, Catherine Austin Fisk. I mean, we got a movement rolling here. Nobody's talking about it, but we got a movement, and we got to keep talking about it ourselves and pushing it everywhere we can because we've got to end that war. We got to end it now. I mean, too many people are dying. It's just, you know, go see Robert Greenwald's movie on YouTube called It's ImpeachCheney.org. It's a five-minute thing. I mean, it's really good. Got Greenwald involved. And so impeachment is possible. And, you know, we can't wait another year and a half. But we also can't wait because these laws that have been put in place, the imperial presidency, we can't risk getting even a Democrat in there who's going to go along with these laws. I mean, this is a process of democracy. This is a process of the people saying we demand habeas corpus for everybody in the world. We demand that we're not torturing people to death. And we don't support
an agenda of total military domination of the world, weapons in space, or anything else in that matter. We want to start putting our money into bettering the world, ending poverty, and not building a military machine that's going to go on indefinitely to protect an upper class and protect high-level capital around the world. They got rid of Wolfowitz and the World Bank. We got to get rid of the Bush in the White House and move on in terms of those kinds of capacities. So that's probably enough. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program by Global Voices for Justice. This talk by Peter Phillips on Project Censored 2007, given at the First Unitarian Universalist Church of San Diego, California, on July 25th, 2007. This is Manos Kappas from Athens, Greece. Global Voices for Justice is a non-profit media organization in Los Angeles, California. To contact us or obtain copies of this or other programs, please visit our website at globalvoicesforjustice.org.
Oh, projectcensor.org is our website. You know, last year, 12 million hits. Our new healthcare study will be up there probably in a couple of weeks. You can see the global dominance study, which lists the 237 neoconservatives who are pushing a global dominance agenda. And you can see the special study we did on electromagnetic weapons and the kinds of things they're building to fry our brains.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
I was driving down some big highway, somewhere going someplace, through a town that looked just like the last. I passed a billboard that said, if I buy that shit I'd feel better. I just pulled off to fill up the gas. In the truck stop TV showed the president's face, with the stars and stripes waving in back. He said, my fellow Americans, I can assure you today, peace and freedom is why we attacked. And it's days like these I find myself growing cold, trying to hold the rage that I feel. In this country of hearts that are freezing like ice, in this nation asleep at the wheel, I feel like I'm clear cut. I feel like my rivers have run dry, and I'm raw beneath the open sky and the rain. When it comes, will carry me